find absorbing feature articles online. abc.net.au/rn.
Across Australia on RN or via podcast, great to have your company for this edition of Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Ancient wisdom, does it matter in a modern world? Anthropologist Wade Davis takes a look at some of the communities and cultures that have resisted modernity and explains why their very different way of seeing and thinking about the world is important. Wade Davis, later tonight on Big Ideas. But first, what happens when the factory closes? In small regional communities, it can mean the viability of the entire town is called into question. But in some places, rather than simply throwing in the towel, workers, suppliers, producers, and indeed whole communities are gathering together to consider alternatives. So what are the options and possibilities when a factory closes? A range of ideas were explored at the ACTU Congress in Melbourne earlier this year. In this discussion, Rick Duke, the public officer at the Fleurieu Association, explains what happened when late last year a poultry factory in regional South Australia closed down. We'll hear how the campaign by the former workers to restart the business as a cooperative is proceeding. Our moderator is columnist for The Guardian Australia and self-proclaimed co-op enthusiast, Van Badham. And first up, to explain how the social enterprise model differs from the standard approach to business, here's Melina Morrison, CEO of the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutuals, presenters of tonight's forum.
So cooperatives are those businesses, those enterprises, those organisations which are owned by stakeholders which aren't the people venturing capital. They're the people who are the members, such that they might be the suppliers to the cooperative, they might be the producers, such as a agriculture cooperative. In an employee-owned cooperative, they are the workers, or they can be the consumers, the customers, if you like. So you've got something like a credit union, which is a customer-owned bank. Globally, it's a huge sector. There are a billion citizens of the world who are member owners of businesses that are cooperatively organised. The top 300 of the estimated 1.5 million of these enterprises, there goes the buzz, turns over $2 trillion worth of throughput to their economies, and that's equivalent to, say, an economy with a GDP of, say, Canada. So it's a really substantial sector, and it's having a resurgence because there's something broke in the economic system. And we need other models, diverse models of enterprise, to be able to bring other objectives to business that are not about simply about maximising profit. You need profits to stay in business, obviously, but not about maximising profits and alone, and not necessarily about serving the capital in the company. They're formed for a different reason.
One of the reasons why cooperative movements have attracted a lot of press recently is looking at economic downturns, particularly in economies like Greece. There have been, in the wake of the Greece economic disaster, where there's been a lot of capital flight from that country, as well as a lot of just failed corporate projects, what we've seen in Greece is workers literally seizing the means of production, can you imagine, and setting up their own businesses almost in the wreckage of the failed economy in front of them. Would you like to give us a couple of examples of what's going on in Greece, Melina?
Greece is a great example because, like Spain and like other parts of the European Union, there's almost dystopian levels of unemployment, particularly amongst the youth. Now, in these countries, whilst there are squabbles going on with the debt facility to the company, Greece is broke. People are needing to organise to address their very, very urgent needs around their wages, around work, and around social cohesion. So whilst other parts of the economy in Greece are breaking down and communities breaking down, we're seeing a fantastic example in just, I'll give you one example, which is called the Voimi factory, which is, it does industrial products, building products, manufacture. What those workers did, and they've been doing it since around 2012, is occupying the plant, which was abandoned, as happened in Argentina. And if anyone's seen Naomi Klein's wonderful documentary, The Take, you'll see what the people did in Argentina. So the workers occupied the abandoned plant in order to start the enterprise again and then organise themselves into solidarity around how they were going to manage the business, create a surplus and pay themselves, hopefully, a living wage. We're seeing a similar response in areas of France. In Spain, the only area to be able to combat the high levels of unemployment is in the Basque region of Mondragon in northern Spain, where a series of worker cooperatives are organised into an industrial conglomerate called the Mondragon Corporation, and that's the 10th largest business in Spain, and they've been able to survive the GFC and come out the other end with retaining as much of the high levels of employment that they could.
For those of you who aren't familiar with Mondragon, it really is the paragon of cooperative enterprises. Mondragon was actually started under Franco, but because it was part of the Basque region, which was obviously somewhat separatist, it flew under the radar of Franco's administration. Mondragon started as quite a small cooperative, I think just based around an agricultural crop, and as that cooperative became more confident and more successful, it encouraged the formulation of other cooperatives within the supply chain. So from going from being primary producers, Mondragon went into processing, from processing into manufacturing. Mondragon now employs more than 70,000 people in the Basque region as a cooperative in a series of interconnected cooperatives, and they even produce white goods now, don't they? Mm-hmm. So as an example of the transformative power of a radical form of economic organising, what is also going on with Mondragon, and I'd love Melina to talk about this because it's amazing, is representatives of Mondragon are actually going to traditional steel producing communities in the United States and teaching steel producers how to run cooperatives.
That's one of the most exciting exchanges of information, which is a cooperative value, I guess. It's cooperation amongst cooperatives. The US Steelworkers Union has set up a model which is based on what they've learnt from their Mondragon colleagues that's called union cooperatives. In these cooperatives, they're organised around the power is vested in the worker owners, so around a general assembly. The general assembly of the workers elects a board of management. It also elects its union representatives. Now, the board of management are the directors of and the representatives of the worker assembly then go and hire management, senior management, executive management to help them actually facilitate the function of some of these highly complex businesses. So in fact, it's an inverse relationship, power relationship, where management is hired by the workers, by the employees. The role of the unions is part of the structure. So in order to try and create a brokerage, a panel, and advisors between the employee owners and management around work conditions, around how to organise the distribution and the fair share of surpluses created by the business, that role is delegated to the unions. So they're very much part of the effective functioning of the business. And what the steelworkers are really having to confront in a very brave way there is that the blue-collar part of the industry has gone offshore. It's not competitive in this global market with the competition around the cost of labour from outside the US. So they're really looking at building a new steel manufacturing industry that's around what you might call more middle class employment. So they're economically restructuring the sector in order to create viable jobs for the future, but they're doing it in concert with another part of the cooperative movement and with the union movement.
It's quite extraordinary when you consider the diversity of businesses that can embrace a cooperative model. Reading about the cooperative movements around the world is always very exciting. Stories of waiters occupying restaurants in Spain and running cooperatives out of restaurants. In France, there's an extremely good example of a tea company that had all but collapsed. The owners had vacated the premises and the workers occupied the factory, and it's now one of the most successful tea businesses in the world. In Australia, my own experience in cooperatives in the artistic sector is overwhelmingly the bulk of artistic product in the collaborative artistic product in Australia, whether you're looking at small and independent galleries, if you're looking at theatre productions, if you're looking at bands and live music. All of these enterprises are run as cooperatives. So we actually have a tradition within our own community for embracing this kind of structure based around sharing and worker responsibility and worker-based enterprise. Very excitingly, I'm going to introduce Rick Duke now from the Flerio Poultry Cooperative in beautiful South Australia. So Rick can tell us his story. The summary is, I did an article about Rick and the miracle of Flerio Poultry last year. It was one of the most successful, most read articles I've ever written for The Guardian about what happened in that area and how an intersection of groups, a truly miraculous collaboration of the National Union of Workers, the local farming community and also local small business have all been part of a conversation supported by the South Australian State Government, very crucially, to look at a new form of enterprise in that region. So Rick, can you talk us through the story of what happened to you in Flerio, where you started and where you are now?
Sure, thanks. So we closed down in December of last year, and it was the National Union of Workers that ridiculously suggested that we could set up a community co-op to keep the factory up and running. And while I was bamboozled by that suggestion, and initially the more we get into it, the more we realise that the co-ops do exist, they run very successfully, and definitely is a possibility for any business to set up that model. So the National Union of Workers initially drove that. I guess we got a bit lucky because at the same time as we were closing down, we had some primary producers who run beef throughout the Flerio. A lot of them want to set up diverse farms, so they want to run poultry on their properties because that is very good for their farming operation, that they can reduce disease and increase profits, and it's just better all round for their farms. So we got a bit lucky that we had that sort of groundswell of primary producers, as well as our factory closing down. In fact, one of our primary producers had been ringing up our factory in the 6 months before they announced closure to see if they could get birds processed at that plant, and being owned by a big multinational, of course, the answer was no. So what we've done in the months since then is we've engaged some consultants to help us do some fact-finding studies throughout the Flerio Peninsula, try and estimate how many producers there are, how many birds we can get, whether there is a market for it. So we're talking to the restaurants and any other distributors. And we're going from there. The state government's come on board with funding for that feasibility study. Stage one finished yesterday, and we've sent a report off to the department, and we're hoping that as of tomorrow they meet and they will hopefully come back to us to say that yes, we can move to stage two, which will involve a bit more fact-finding, but also the writing up of a detailed business plan so that we can then look to get the finance to get the factory back up and running. But it's been really exciting. The more I get involved in this, I think we just don't realise in Australia just how many co-ops are out there. I think sometimes we hear of companies and we just assume they're big businesses, and in fact they're co-ops or mutuals, and it's quite heartening to know that they're out there and they exist. The support that you get from other co-ops is fantastic. We've got a fairly close association with the Goulburn Valley Co-op in Victoria, and they have been on board, have funded some of my wages and offering advice, and so we don't have to go through and learn lessons ourselves. We can call on the experience of others that have been there before. And in the last week, we've really had some positive developments with some big suppliers. Up until, I'd say, 2 weeks ago, it looked like we were going to start small scale, perhaps in a not utilising the factory that closed down, but perhaps building a smaller factory on someone's property. But in the last week, yeah, with some big suppliers on board and potentially some producers, we're very confident that the factory will reopen and probably in a much bigger capacity than what we initially thought.
Rick Duke, public officer with the Fleurieu Association. On RN online or via podcast, you're with Big Ideas. Also taking part in this discussion is Melina Morrison, CEO of the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutuals.
To give some more context about various other cooperative projects that are going on around Australia at the moment, obviously one of the great areas for cooperative potential is in the creation of clean energy. The very nature of decentralised energy and local energy sources like wind and like solar encourages the notion of community investment and community partnership around the creation and running of that infrastructure. In the state of Victoria, a really good example is Hepburn Wind, which is a wind farm, which is a cooperative that exists of community members running their own local power supply in order to not only deliver cleaner, greener and sustainable outcomes, but also to take responsibility for job creation within the community and the provision of basic community infrastructure. So you can imagine that there is an inherent logic, given the challenge this poses to certain invested forms of centralised capital, perhaps represented by the federal government and the Liberal Party, that it may be one of the reasons why things like the renewable energy target, which would certainly create established markets for decentralised power and projects like this, a certain resistance can be identified, because it is a challenge to doing business as usual, isn't it, Melina? It is a challenge to the sort of top-down pyramidical corporate structure.
It's a challenge, but it's amazing how, as Rick said, how prevalent it is and how much it's actually done. Like, a lot of this is a kind of collective blind spot, I think, to what's going on in other parts of the economy that add into, you know, to a really sustainable economy overall. If you have more distributed power, distributed ownership, and a part of the economy that doesn't rest on speculation, then you're going to have a more stable economy. So in Australia, we say that there's 8 in 10 of us, Australians, being members of a cooperative or mutual, which sounds incredible. But if you think about those mutual organisations which you're a part of, which you are actually an owner of, even if you're not aware of it, from motorist mutuals through to the co-op, you know, if you were at university and you joined up the co-op bookshop, you're still an owner, member of that. Agricultural cooperatives, you might purchase something like Nimbin cheese or Devondale milk, through to the housing cooperatives, the social cooperatives that are out there, customer-owned banks. Many of us have had a credit union account or a building society account at some time, if we still don't now, and many of us are members of member-owned a credit union, super industry funds, but also health mutuals. So it is a challenge to the economy in the sense that we need to recognise that this is happening. There's value in having more of it happening in different parts of the economy. But the challenge really is around awareness, Van. I think to see that the models are there and can be replicated, for example, in Rick's case, with what they're trying to do with their new venture, their business venture.
So my first question, I've got a couple for Rick. What have you learned in your journey from a worker at Ingham's, you know, working at Aldinga Turkeys, it was, to now being like a cooperative activist? Like, what have you learned in that journey? And my question to Melina, and probably to Rick as well, what do you think are the biggest barriers for workers' cooperatives being set up in Australia, and what could we as a union movement do to assist, like, the alternative economic solution to a lot of the issues that we face in Australia?
Okay, so Rick, what have you learnt on your journey from knife hand to cooperative activist?
What I've learned is I'm a little bit in Van's corner here. I mean, the passion that I've got for co-ops over the last 6 months is incredible. Reading the stories and seeing, I guess, firsthand, is that you don't just run a business, you run an organisation that hopefully makes some profit so that you can run that business, but then you give back to the communities. And the Goulburn Valley Co-op, I'll harp on that a little bit, but, you know, they run food in schools programs so that they have kids setting up their own, you know, sort of veggie patches in schools so that they can learn about gardening and fresh food, and that tomatoes actually aren't these hard balls of plastic that you buy from the supermarket, but they're these tasty little red things that come out the ground. And I just think co-ops have got such an important part in not just economies, but in social engagement. And for me, that's the biggest thing. And I guess also just learning how many co-ops are out there. As I said, I just had no idea how well they do and how many co-ops are out there. And I think one of our MPs in South Australia quoted something like, if you took the top 300 co-ops from around the world, it would equate to the 10th largest economy in the world. And I mean, that's just an amazing figure. So I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot about business, because I actually have a public service background. Don't hold that against me. So I'm learning a lot about business. I'm learning a lot about co-ops and the value they can give back to economies and to communities.
Is it empowering?
It's very empowering. I'm a little bit, talking with Alexandra before, and we sort of feel like preachers at times, and I have to find myself holding myself back from jumping up and down and waving my hands around when I talk to people about it, because I come across as a bit more of an idiot than what I really am.
We're all idiots on this table then. The light in the eyes of the cooperative zealots. Melina, what are the obstructions to realising cooperative potential within Australia?
Well, the big thing is the education piece, but I think some of those other barriers, like capital, is a huge, huge challenge, and Rick's group will face this. You know, at some stage, there's going to be the need for large sums of money to be found through a mix of debt that the business venture could go into, like any, you know, business in startup, and the equity you can raise from your members and your business community, the partners that you're building, so that mutual aid thing that's happening at the moment. Those things, they're challenges, but they can all be overcome, particularly through doing things cooperatively in terms of exchanging information and resources. There's such a great role for unions here. Unions, I think the big thing is to drop the fear side of it. The fear of it being, of the union movement having a different role to play in workplace empowerment through, or a parallel role, which is actually to create and stimulate and help support enterprise development, where workers are self-electing to take this on, to create a workplace which is devoid of bosses, which is devoid of the old hierarchies, which have been such an important place for unions to participate in with the collective bargaining. This is a different style of collective bargaining. If the union movement can get their head around another parallel role to be playing in the workplaces of the future, I think that's just such an exciting thing. And I'm sure with, you know, basically what Rick's group is doing is building it from the ground up with the support of a union. That needs to be captured so that it can be emulated with the next group that want to do it, you know.
And I think the important thing also with the union is that, and I can't talk on behalf of the union, but the National Union of Workers, I think what they're looking at is that, yeah, sure, okay, so another factory shut down, Do they keep going in and beating their heads against the wall, trying to convince large corporations to keep a local business open, when perhaps the large business is going to say, well, look, it just doesn't make sense from a business case to keep this factory open? So the union's thinking outside the square, how can we save jobs? How can we create jobs that doesn't involve negotiating with a large company? And that's where the National Union of Workers has come up with this idea of a co-op, because it is a way to create jobs. And I think at the end of the day, that's what a union's for, is about. Well, it's one of the tasks of a union, of course, is to secure jobs and to keep jobs. And by creating a co-op, hopefully we get to do that.
We've already got mainstream policies about employment, self-employment, about small businesses, about big businesses, but there doesn't seem to be any genuine engagement with this sector, with at least in the federal sphere government. So do any of you have any ideas about how we can actually drive that?
I'm so glad you asked that question.
Such a great question.
Absolutely. This, I don't know if you've noticed, but the government's talking a lot about innovation and small business, entrepreneurialism, and, stimulating the 70% of the economy, which is independent businesses, which is created by Australians for Australians. Cooperatives are champions of independent business, because basically what you're doing is you're creating collective bargaining to be able to be in the, in the marketplace as a buyer or seller by joining up with other people, whether you're workers joining up or whether you're small businesses, SMEs. The government does get that. The current small business minister does understand what cooperatives do, but they haven't joined the dots around, if they're going to do a big piece on innovation and incubating, they absolutely have to include information and advice for people, groups, communities who want to form cooperatives as the vehicle for getting the enterprise going. There's a really neat relationship, perhaps, between the trade union movement, government, and enterprise development that can put workers at the centre and people at the centre of those businesses that are created, so that the value of the enterprise is returned to the people doing the enterprise. And Rick said something in his description of what they're doing, which was about innovation. So a fantastic idea to create an integrated, I think Vans described it, integrated agriculture and food business system in the Fleurieu area was not what the original owners of the factory in Ingham's case wanted, because it didn't fit their model. It's not an embracing of innovation. Here we have the potential to create innovative enterprise, and if we can get that message through to government, it's actually not a piece of work that needs a lot of money in this era of fiscal constraint, but all of those government-funded enterprise programs, the information websites currently without information on the cooperative model of doing things need to be improved.
Certainly, there's scope to argue for a resourcing. Any of you who may be doing a bit of party policy for any random political parties at the moment, there's definitely scope to invest in the development of models that extend the model used by the new enterprise incentive scheme to incentive schemes for cooperative businesses. For those of you who aren't familiar with the new enterprise incentive scheme, it's an option that is offered to you as opposed to going on a job seeker and seeking the benefits for seeking work. The new enterprise incentive scheme provides you with support from the department to start your own business, but as a sole trader, as a sole practitioner. The new enterprise incentive scheme is one of the jewels in the crown of actual job and business development in this country. It's some incredible figure that, like, within 6 months of completing the new enterprise incentive scheme, those who've gone through it are in self-sustaining work at some incredible rate. It's like two-thirds of the people who go through through that program. I would need to check the figures on that, as opposed to merely being on the Job Seekers Allowance, which has much lower employment outcomes, or, God help you, if you put on Work for the Dole, where your employment outcomes actually drop as a result of being on Work for the Dole because of loss of morale and because of effective de-skilling through those programs. So in a policy sense, looking at providing support like for the New Enterprise Incentive Scheme for cooperatives is one of the most innovative, positive contributions that policymakers could make to a new economy. Absolutely. Rick, I wondered if you could talk about the support that you've got from the South Australian government and how they've been able to support you at Fleurio.
Thanks, Vet. Just before I talk about that, I'm sure I'm going to get this wording wrong, but the South Australian government's just passed an act for a bill to reform laws nationally that actually assist co-ops to get started. Governments are starting to understand that we have a big role to play, but we have a lot of barriers, and finance is obviously one of the key barriers there. So the government has recognised that and wants to enact some laws that can assist co-ops to get up and running more readily, because we're now 6 months since we've closed down, and while we're making large inroads, in realistic terms, we're still a long way from starting off, and that's not helping those people who haven't got jobs, and they're obviously getting pretty frustrated now. So if governments can do that, then that's a good thing. So from our point of view, the government came on board right from the start. We were talking to our ministers for agriculture and manufacturing before we actually even shut the doors, and then they have granted us this money for our feasibility study. And it's not cheap. I mean, it's not a huge amount of money in government terms, but nonetheless, it's still a significant amount of money that we couldn't have come up with, certainly not at this early stage anyway, if it wasn't from the government. They've pretty much given us, free range to a degree to go out and find our consultants and to plan things the way we think is best done. And they're overseeing, and of course they want to make sure that we're using their money wisely, and that's fair enough and understandable. But really, that they are just at this stage overseeing and making sure that we're doing things. So in that regard, the support they're giving us is great, because they're not trying to control us, they're not trying to tell us what we should and shouldn't do. They just want to make sure that they can see us making progress, spending their money wisely, and I think they're also looking at this in South Australia. We have factories closing down virtually every couple of weeks, so I think the government's recognising that this is a real way they can create some jobs and get some good news stories.
Rick Duke, public officer at the Fleurio Association, and taking part in this discussion was Melina Morrison, CEO of the Business Council of Cooperatives and Mutuals, presenters of this forum, which was held earlier this year as part of the ACTU Congress in Melbourne. Our thanks to our moderator, Guardian Australia columnist Van Badham. And as a footnote to that discussion, the Fleurio Association's feasibility study, funded by the South Australian Government, has now been completed, and the association is currently negotiating with the state government in the hope that it will underwrite a bank loan to restart the business. For more information, head to the Big Ideas homepage, abc.net.au/rn. And now, ancient wisdom, why it matters in the modern world. Your speaker is Wade Davis, the Canadian anthropologist, explorer in residence at the National Geographical Society, author and photographer. In this talk, Davis shares a fascinating insight into a number of very different ways of thinking about the world, from Polynesia to the Arctic Circle, from the Dreamtime to the mountains of Tibet. There are still places where modernity is being resisted. Here's Wade Davis.
In the last 20 years, scientists have proved a philosopher's dream to be true. And that is the fact that we're all brothers and sisters. And I don't mean that in the spirit of hippie ethnography. I mean, we're all cut from the same genetic cloth. the human genetic endowment is a single continuum. Race has been exposed as an utter fiction. Indeed, studies of the Y chromosome in the male descent line of humanity and mitochondrial DNA in the female descent line of humanity have left no doubt whatsoever that we're all descended from a handful of people who walked out of Africa some 60,000 years ago and then embarked on this extraordinary hegira, 40,000 years in the making, 2,500 human generations that carried the human spirit to every corner of the habitable world. But if you accept that we're all cut from the same genetic cloth, you have to accept the fact that all cultures share the same raw genius, the same human potential, the same mental acuity. And whether this genius is invested into technological wizardry, which has been the great achievement in the West, or by contrast, placed into unraveling the complex threads of memory inherent in a myth, is simply a matter of choice and cultural orientation. There is no progress in the affairs of culture. There's no ladder to success that runs from the savage to the barbarian to the civilized of the Strand in London. That old Victorian idea that there was a pyramid at the apex of which sat Victorian Europe that sloped down to the so-called primitives of the world has been utterly exposed as an artifact of the 19th century, as relevant to our lives today as a notion that clergymen had in that era that the earth was only 6,000 years old. And this stunning affirmation of the human spirit, science has proven the essential interconnectedness of humanity. And what this means is that the other cultures of the world aren't failed attempts at being new, let alone failed attempts at being modern. Quite to the contrary, each is a fundamental answer to a fundamental question. What does it mean to be human and alive? And when the myriad of cultures of the world answer that question, they do so in 7,000 different languages. And those languages collectively become our human repertoire for dealing with the challenges that will confront us as a species in the ensuing millennia. But what do I mean by different cultures making for different manifestations of the human spirit? Let's slip for a moment to the greatest culture sphere ever brought into being by the human imagination, Polynesia. Tens of thousands of islands flung like jewels upon a southern sea. I sailed recently in the Hokulea, a recreated sacred canoe based on the models that were sketched by Joseph Banks in his journals as he sailed with Captain Cook in the 18th century. And even today, the sailors of the Polynesian Voyaging Society can name 300 stars in the night sky. They can identify the presence of distant atolls of islands beyond the visible horizon simply by watching the reverberation of waves across the hull of the vessel, knowing full well that every island in the group of the Pacific has its own unique refractive pattern that can be read with the same perspicacity with which a forensic scientist would read a fingerprint. In the darkness in the hull of the vessels, they can distinguish as many as 5 different sea swells moving through the canoe at any one point in time, distinguishing those caused by local weather disturbances from the deep currents that pulsate across the ocean and can be followed with the same ease with which a terrestrial explorer would follow a river to the sea. Indeed, if you took all of the genius that allowed us to put a man on the moon and applied it to an understanding of the ocean, what you would get is Polynesian. The most amazing thing is the entire tradition was based on dead reckoning. You only knew where you were by remembering how you got there. And the Polynesians did not have the written word. So over the course of a multi-week journey, the wayfinder had to sit monk-like in the stern of the vessel, remembering every shift of the wind, every sign of the stars, every sign of the sea, the celestial bodies. And it was fear, it was the impossibility of doing this over a long oceanic voyage that kept Europeans hugging the shores of continents. But we know that 10 centuries before Christ, the ancestors of the Polynesians set sail into the rising sun. Now, if you go to the greatest forest sphere, we enter the Amazon, the homeland of the people of the Anaconda, the Barasana, the Macuna, the Tanimucos, who cognitively do not distinguish the color green from the color blue because the canopy of the heavens is equated to the canopy of the rainforest. A people who have wisdom traditions that honor the man of knowledge as opposed to the warrior, social structures that facilitate peace, not war, not the least of which is that you must marry someone who speaks a different language. And so in any one Maloka, you'll have 6 and 7 languages spoken, but you never hear a child reciting a particular language or practicing. They simply listen, wait, watch, and one day begin to speak. And what we've come to understand is that the mythologies of these societies are nothing more or less than a complex land management plan that dictates precisely how human beings in great numbers can live in the Amazon rainforest. These societies are indeed the descendants of the ancient civilizations which once numbered tens of millions of people in the Amazon. Now slip into the realm of the spirit, into the homeland of Tibet. I recently made a film which we call The Buddhist Science of the Mind. Why would you use the term science for what you think is a religion? Well, what is science but the empirical pursuit of the truth? What is Tibetan Buddhism but 2,500 years of direct empirical observation as to the nature of mind? My good friend Matthieu Ricard began his life as the son of the most illustrious Descartesian philosopher in France. His mother was a famous painter. He learned photography from Cartier-Bresson. He was taught piano by Stravinsky. He learned anthropology at the feet of Claude Lévi-Strauss. But one day he realized there was no correlation between fame, wealth, and happiness. He went back to where he had always been happy, Tibet, and became ordained as a monk. He used to say to me that Western science is too often a major response to minor needs. We spend all of our lifetime trying to live to be 100 without losing our teeth. The Tibetan spends all their lifetime trying to understand the nature of existence. Our billboards, he said, celebrate naked teenagers in underwear. The billboards in Tibet are manuals, prayers for the well-being of all sentient creatures. And the essence of the Buddhist path, the path that so offended Mao Zedong, the individual who incidentally was responsible for the death of more of his own people in his lifetime than Hitler and Stalin combined, what was it that so offended the Marxist materialists of Beijing? The Four Noble Truths, all life is suffering. By that, the Buddha didn't mean life was negative, he meant shit happens. The second of the Noble Truths was that the cause of suffering was ignorance. That simply meant that, not negation or stupidity, but the tendency of human beings to cling to the illusion, the cruel illusion of their own centrality in the stream of divine existence. The third of the Noble Truths was a revelation that ignorance could be overcome. And the fourth was the delineation of a contemplative practice that, if followed, not only had the possibility of a transformation of the human heart, but had 2,500 years of empirical evidence to say that that transformation would indeed happen. And so with my good friend Shara Barma, a traditional Amshi doctor who spent 1 year in solitary retreat in this cave as part of his medical training, and with Matthieu chanting the sutras, we went in pursuit of the true wisdom hero of the East, to the slopes of Mount Everest, not to go into a zone of death where oxygen deprivation obliterates consciousness, which for the Tibetan is about the stupidest thing you can possibly do. We went to be in the presence of a wisdom hero, a woman who as a young girl had escaped the clutches of a suitor, crawling down a latrine, covered with excrement, turned up the monastery, became ordained as a nun after she had crossed the mountains into Tibet, came back into this realm, and for 45 years she lived in a cell no larger than this corner of the stage. By the terms of reference of our society, we should have been met by a madwoman. We were met by a woman whose face radiated loving compassion. For the Tibetan, this is the proof of the efficacy of the science of the mind that is the Dharma, the serenity achieved by the practitioner. And later that day, a lama in that nunnery adjacent monastery said to me an interesting thing. He said, you know, we in Tibet don't believe that you went to the moon, but you did. You may not believe that we achieve enlightenment in one lifetime, but we do. Now, following this anthropological metaphor, let's go into the realm of the sacred, sacred geography. What does it mean to be a people who really believe that the earth is alive, that human beings have reciprocal obligations to it, even as they have obligations to the earth? In the Andes, a young lad is raised not to believe that a mountain is a pile of rock ready to be mined, but that it's an Apu spirit, a deity that will direct his destiny. This has huge consequences in terms of the relationship between that culture, in particular its ecological footprint. Now, if we go to the one part of South America never vanquished in a blood-stained continent by the Spanish, we enter the realm of the elder brother, the Arawako and the Kohi, descendants of the ancient Tairona civilization that carpeted the Caribbean coastal plain of Colombia. In the wake of the conquest, they retreated into an isolated massif where to this day they're ruled by a ritual priesthood. The acolytes are taken away from the families at the age of 2 and 3, sequestered in a shadowy world of darkness for 18 years, during which time they absorb all the Baroque cosmology of the society, including the conviction that their prayers and their prayers alone maintain the cosmic balance. After 18 years, they're led out into the dawn. And for the first time, they see the world as it is, theirs to protect. They go off on a pilgrimage through a sacred landscape where every ripple in the rock resonates with significance. And from the high ice of the mountains to the sea, where the sacred sites are now covered by temples of concrete and rebar, they still utter their prayers. They believe that their prayers maintain the cosmic balance. They say that we are the younger brother who has ruined the world. And it's amazing to think that 2 hours from Miami Beach, these mamos are praying, as I sit here today, for our collective well-being.
Wade Davis, anthropologist and explorer in residence at the National Geographical Society. On RN or online at abc.net.au, you're with Big Ideas. Back now to Wade Davis and his talk, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters.
Come to the place that was the antithesis of the Descartesian world of Europe into your own homeland of Australia. When the British first met the Aboriginal people, they saw people who looked strange, who had a simple technology, who, to the offense of the British, had no interest in improving upon their lot. For the British, this was unconscionable because, of course, progress, optimism was the ethos of their age, notions that died in the mud and blood of Flanders, but were very much alive when the British first washed ashore in Australia. And because the Aboriginal people seemed so different, the British, in their inimitable way, concluded they weren't people at all. And in 1902, while my grandfather lived in this city of Melbourne, Australia, it was debated in the Parliament as to whether Aboriginal people were human beings at all. But what was missing was the British inability to understand the subtle devotional philosophy of these first people to walk out of Africa. We know that the Aboriginal people, within 5,000 years, their ancestors came upon this parsimonious continent, and then they went walking, establishing 10,000 clan territories like a matrix. Clan territories connected by a single concept, the dreaming. The dreaming wasn't a dream, it was a state of perpetual existence in which past, present, and future fused into one. In not one of the 670 languages and dialects of Australia was there a word for past, present, future, or time. There was only the dreaming. And the entire purpose in life in Australia was the antithesis of progress. It was to do the ritual gestures deemed to be necessary within your clan territory to keep the world exactly as it was at the time of the rainbow serpent. It would be as if all the efforts in the West, in all of our history, had been invested into pruning the shrubs in the Garden of Eden to maintain it just as it was at the time when Adam and Eve had their fateful conversation. The question isn't to say who's right and who's wrong. Had humanity as a whole followed this particular intellectual devotion, yes, we wouldn't have put a man on the moon. But on the other hand, we wouldn't be talking about climate change and our capacity to transform the biological life support systems of the planet. Similarly, when the British first reached my homeland of Canada, they saw people who looked odd, and the Inuit took the British to be gods, the British took the Inuits to be savages. Both were wrong, one did more to honor the human race. And what the British failed to understand was that there was no better measure of genius than the ability to survive in that harsh environment on a technology that was limited to what you could forge from the cold. The Inuit didn't fear the cold, they took advantage of it. The runners of their sleds were originally made of fish, three Arctic char laid in a row and wrapped in the skin of a caribou hide. The Inuit didn't fear the cold, they took advantage of it. For them, blood on ice was not the sign of death, but an affirmation of life itself. And when the British mimicked their ways, they achieved great feats of exploration. When they failed to do so, they suffered terrible deaths. When the last of Lord Franklin's men were found frozen to death at Starvation Cove on the Adelaide Peninsula, the young sailors were dragging behind them a sled made of oak and iron built in Manchester, England, that weighed 500 pounds. On top of it was a dory from Franklin's ship that weighed 300 pounds. Inside the dory were all the accoutrements of a British naval officer's dinner service, including silver plate and a copy of the novel, The Vicar of Wakefield. This they expected to drag through the immense reaches of northern Canada, hoping to bump into a Hudson Bay post and achieve salvation. Well, of course, they suffered terrible deaths, but the Inuit moved lightly on the land. Cold for them is something to be taken advantage of. When I took this photograph, I was polar bear hunting. That night, the temperature dropped to minus 65 Celsius before the wind came up. We simply made an igloo, got into the robes, got the oil lamps going, and ate raw meat. I was narwhal hunting at the tip of Baffin Island when I recorded a wonderful story from Olaik. During the 1950s, a dark period of Canadian history, we forced the Inuit into settlements to establish our own sovereignty in an archipelago that could have gone back to the Europeans. This man's grandfather categorically refused to go into the settlement, so the family, fearful for his life, took away of his weapons, his tools, thinking that would oblige him to settle down. Did it? No. In the middle of an Arctic night, the old man slipped outside of the igloo, pulled down his caribou hide trousers, and defecated into his hand. As the feces began to freeze, he shaped it in the form of an implement. And when the implement, forged by the cold from human waste, took final form, he put a spray of saliva along the leading edge and used the implement as a knife to kill a dog. He skinned the dog, improvised the traces of a sled with the skin of the dead dog, improvised a sled from the rib cage of the dead dog, and then, harnessing up an adjacent living dog and shit knife in belt, disappeared into the Arctic night. Now, talk about getting by with nothing. And that is a kind of a symbol of the resilience of this culture. Even the way the Inuit people think is informed by the ebb and flow of ice. They are people of the ice, but the ice is melting. This is a photograph I took at the northernmost community in the world of Kanak, northwest Greenland, when the ice used to come in September and stay till July. Now it comes in November and is gone by March. Their world is literally melting from beneath them. So why do any of these cultures matter? You know, we have this notion that, quaint and colorful though they may be, they're somehow destined to fade away as if by natural law, as if they're failed attempts at being modern, failed attempts at being us. Nothing could be further from the truth. Change is no threat to culture. All cultures are always dancing with new possibilities for life. Technology is no threat to culture, but power is. In every case, these are dynamic, living peoples being driven out of existence by external forces. And that's actually an optimistic observation, because it suggests if human beings are the agents of cultural destruction, we can be the facilitators of cultural survival. But we better get on with it. Because of the 7,000 languages spoken in the world the day that you were born, today fully half aren't being whispered into the ears of infants. Now, a language isn't just vocabulary and grammar. A language is a flash of the human spirit. Every language is an old-growth forest of a mind, a watershed of thought, an ecosystem of social and spiritual possibilities. And every 2 weeks, somewhere on the planet, an elder dies and carries with him or her into the grave the last syllables of an ancient tongue. And what this means is that this entire body of knowledge, which I've just begun to give you a sense of, half of it is slipping away within our lifetimes. And this does not have to happen. Why are these cultures so important? In part because they tell us that there are other options, other ways of being, other visions of life itself. And they put the lie to those who say we cannot change, as we know we must change, the fundamental way in which we inhabit this planet. Culture is not trivial. It's not decorative. It's the body of ethical and moral values that we place around each individual to keep at bay the barbaric heart that history teaches us lies within each human being. It is culture that allows us to make sense of sensation, to find order and meaning in a universe that may have none, to always reach for the better angel of our nature. And so if you want to know what happens when culture is lost, look around the world to the points of chaos. The issue isn't the traditional versus the modern. How do we find ways for all peoples to benefit from the genius of modernity without that engagement demanding the death of who they are? How do we find a way that all peoples in all gardens continue to flourish even as we move in this truly polychromatic world of diversity in which every culture and every voice has a place at the council of human wisdom and knowledge? Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Wade Davis, anthropologist, author, and explorer in residence at the National Geographical Society. And that's Big Ideas for tonight and for the week. On behalf of the Big Ideas production team, I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now.
15 years old, I'm already moving out of home, and I don't care who I'm dealing drugs to, because I was blinded. I wasn't the person that obviously I should have been.
On The Spirit of Things, two angry young men talk about their descent into violence.
You know, I'd never really wanted to be a gang leader. It all came from, you know, like all the continued assaults that I had leading up to that, like six times a day.
Regrets, Reflections, and Redemption. The Spirit of Things. We're at the RN homepage.